The following program brought to you by Comprehensive Financial Consultants and CFCI, which is solely responsible for its content. Securities are offered through J.W. Cole Financial, member FINRA and SIPC. Investment advice offered through CFCI and J.W. Cole Advisors. J.W. Cole Financial, J.W. Cole Advisors, and CFCI are unaffiliated entities. The opinions expressed by the members of CFCI and their guests should not be construed as specific investment, legal, or tax advice. All economic and performance information is historical and not indicative of future results. Investing may involve the risk of loss of principal, and any tax advice on the show is not intended to be used by any persons for the purpose of avoiding U.S. federal or state tax. Penalties that may be imposed on such persons and each listener should seek advice from their tax advisor or legal counsel on topics that arise from the show. The representatives of CFCI and their guests are not providing legal or tax advice, and nothing should be construed as a solicitation to offer or buy securities. Now enjoy the show.
Is everyone else a little discombobulated like me? It's just a weird week. My wife's been gone, number one, which gives me too much responsibility at home. I have an old dog that is on his last leg, which is terrible. We have just Labor Day weekend coming up, an IU football game. I'm headed to the Edgewood game tomorrow night. I guess we're sponsoring the game ball, so I'm going to try to jump on the air with Joe on Friday night just for a few minutes. I need to text him to let him know that I'm on my coming up there. Yeah, and then Labor Day's here already. It just seems like it popped up out of nowhere. Wow. And then we had this record heat going on. We have cooler weekend coming. So, yeah, just a little discombobulated, but that's okay. That's the way it is, and that's the way we roll. So we are here. Welcome to the big show, Your Money with David Hayes. Happy to have you here. We're going to have Hot Rod on in a few minutes. We're also going to talk about folks. You know, it's interesting because people always want to know where they stand. Like, how do they rank up with other people? People will say to me all the time, so how do we stand up to other people about our age and about our income and all that? Well, I found an article that I thought was pretty interesting based on tax returns of 2024. Pretty interesting. Where do you fall? I'll get into that later in the show. Again, nothing meaningful from that whatsoever, except when you figure out how many people are in your category, it might surprise you how few people are in the category of the people listening to this program. But we'll see. You could be one of my Uber drivers out there as well. Thankfully, my tire problems are behind me, and therefore my Uber days are probably behind me in here in Bloomington. But you never know. You never know. I may decide to start Ubering everywhere from morning to night. But it is kind of expensive. I didn't realize that. I don't Uber enough to know that going out way out towards Lake Monroe, where I live, to Bloomington Tire Barn, where I got my tire fixed, is about a $30 trip. So anyway, I'm going to try to keep out of the Ubers from now on. But thank you for listening, Uber drivers. I appreciate that. The two I took were listeners of the show and program and Glass in the afternoon as well. So thank you for that. Hey, did you see Berkshire Hathaway hits the $1 trillion market value, making it the very first non-tech company to achieve that milestone? The other thing I will say, when you start hearing things at the gym, it's like hearing things in the Uber driver or in the Uber or in the cab or whatever. They were talking about, I was hearing this a lot, like he had like $270 billion or something in treasuries. So folks are like, oh, he must know something. He must know something. I'm like, no, he doesn't know. Here's what he likes. He likes deals, right? And he said, hey, don't look into it too deep why we have so much money sitting in treasuries right now. He said it's been a long time since we've been able to sit around making 5% waiting on a good deal to come along. So don't think he knows something that everybody else doesn't know. He's just waiting on a good deal. And he thinks some good deals will come, and they always do. So we'll just take a back seat to that idea. But congratulations to Berkshire Hathaway. You know, if you hang around long enough and you get old enough and you consistently do things right, you'll get there. He's 93 years old. He warned in his annual letter to investors that more skyrocketing performances are likely a thing of the past, is what he said. So maybe that's why he's sitting in treasuries more than he is in equities. Well, that's not true. He's more in equities and private companies and all that, but he has a pretty substantial stake in cash. I can't wait. Later in the program, I'm going to talk about why gold is outperforming nearly everything so far this year as well. All right, so you guys know early in this whole interest rate environment where things were going up, I was pounding the table about cash accounts inside of brokerage accounts, how we weren't getting paid enough. And I still will tell you we're not getting paid enough. Every firm is a little bit different, whether you're at Schwab, Fidelity, Raymond James, you name it. No one's paying enough on cash. Some are better than others, but no one's paying enough on cash. What's enough? Well, I don't know what enough is. It'd be nice to make 2 or 3% at least, not 0.15 or 0.2 or even, you know, 2 would be fine. And some are paying 2. But we keep seeing these lawsuits, right? There's another one that came out in Financial Planning Magazine that said, hey, the wrongdoing of clients to your firm by not paying them anything on their cash, they make it really hard to manage cash. You can go buy a money market, but it's not a tradable money market. Rod can't go and say, okay, I want to buy this, and it automatically comes out of the sweep account, which is what they're called. He would have to sell the mutual fund that held the money market fund, create the cash to the sweep, and then make the buy. So it's, unless you're handling a couple of accounts, there's no way to practically manage that. So everyone's been, including me, with our custodians, pounding the table, pay us more on cash, come on. And they're saying it's a fiduciary responsibility of the custodian to put the client's best interest in front of their own. Well, everyone's in the business of making money, but something's got to be fair, right? So they're making tons of money on your cash, meaning they're buying the 5% treasury. They're paying you the 0.5%. They're hoping you don't pay attention. Just like the banks. You think the banks are calling you up saying, oh, hey, by the way, Mr. Hayes, you have $100,000 sitting in your checking account and it hasn't changed for 6 months. Would you like to move it to our high-yield money market? Probably not. If you walk into the bank, they might say something to you about it. But not many people walk into banks anymore. So I'm just saying, you've got to take control of stuff. And I can tell you from an advisor standpoint, we're frustrated like you are. We're trying our best to do what we can. But after Rod had a conversation with our relationship person, that our main custodian, and I said, ask him about these lawsuits. Now, none of them have been actually settled yet. They just started getting slung out there like they always do. So all the big firms are getting sued, and they are just, you know, for wrongdoing. And at the end, they're going to have some settlement of, you know, $50 million, which, by the way, is about what the last firm said they made last quarter in their cash sweeps. So they're probably like, screw it, I'm just going to wait to see what the outcome is, and I'll pay the fine, and we'll move on. But then the $50 million, guess how much ends up in the shareholder's pocket? Probably not much. Most of it goes to attorney fees. That's the way it always goes. The system is broke. It's terrible. It always is, you know, one-sided, because if you think about it, or two-sided, both sides of the attorney aisle, because I have been privy to some of these kind of situations before. And what happens is, why would either side settle, right? Because the attorneys keep running the meter. And then it gets to the point where the client says, I can't handle these attorney fees anymore. We need to settle. And you settle for some stupid, ridiculous amount of money. Each attorney takes their 30% out. And then what gets left over, right, is what gets split amongst all the shareholders. And sometimes it's worse than that. Sometimes the contingency gets taken out. Then all of the other fees for discovery and depositions and blah, 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 blah. And the person at the end who was supposed to be getting some money because of the lawsuit gets very, very little. It's just the way the system works, and it's broken. But I can't fix it. I can't take on every single battle for every single person, but I'm just making it aware that, hey, we finally are getting some changes, I think, coming our way. So our relationship person said, because of all these lawsuits, don't be surprised if they finally start paying you something on your sweeps, just about the time interest rates start to go down, right? How nice is that? All right, let's take a quick break. When we come back, we'll get Hot Rod on the phone. We'll talk about what happened in the markets last week, what's happening this week, why treasuries may not be the safe bet they once were, research says, and maybe why gold is outperforming nearly everything so far this year. We'll be right back. It's Your Money with David Hayes. That first segment was brought to you by Kenny Bland Auctions. They are your full service auction service. They offer the pre-planning, the sale of your estate or real estate. Visit them online at kennyblandauctions.com. I'm hoping to see my good friend Dirk and Nikki, and maybe their buddy boy Alex as well. He's playing football at Bloomington South, so we'll see how that all shakes out for the weekend. And Lance Lyke of the Lyke Law Group. I've got some pretty good ads going on right now. Lance, I heard one today, so it's pretty good stuff. But call him. He'll give yourself and your family the peace of mind that comes with proper estate planning. You can catch Lance in the group over at Lyke Law Group, 812-323-8300. Let's talk about last week first. Stocks notched solid gains. as dovish comments from the Federal Reserve officials boosted the market's recovery from early August lows. The S&P, NASDAQ, and Dow all up over 1%. Stocks started the week strong, rallying after Wall Street welcomed those dovish comments from the Minneapolis Fed chair. And the S&P and NASDAQ posted some gains on Monday, the eighth consecutive winning session. The Dow rose for the fifth session in a row. From there, markets traded pretty narrowly until Wednesday afternoon when minutes were released from the July 31st FOMC meeting, revealing a more dovish comments. Then on Thursday, stocks dipped a little bit ahead of Fed Chairman Powell's annual Jackson Hole, Wyoming speech. But then those well-received comments from Powell on Friday boosted markets with all three averages closing higher. And Rod, here we are with a brand new week, and next week will be a shortened week as we celebrate the Labor Day weekend. So a lot of data coming out this week. I had it here with me. We had GDP Friday, jobless claims, home sales. What else? Consumer confidence, durable goods. So we had some pretty good stuff come out this week that are generally some indicators, either past or looking forward. So tell us what's going on now.
Yeah, so those indicators, yeah. Matter of fact, today you had jobless claims came in at 231,000. They were expected to come in at 230,000. So basically in line with that. Big number there is they didn't jump up or anything. So they're coming in roughly in line. And the GDP that you mentioned, it was the second revision of the second quarter GDP number, came in at 3%. The first estimate came out at 2.8, and the expectation from Econo Day was for it to be at 2.8 here on the second one. So it came in a little bit better than expected. So, yeah, economic data continues to show that the economy is doing okay. Would never call it great, just like we've talked about. The consumer is still continuing to do okay, not calling it great, but they most certainly haven't fallen off a cliff. Things aren't coming to a screeching halt. This week was a little bit slow as the market eagerly anticipated NVIDIA's quarterly earnings. And as we've been talking on Glass's show, it used to be kind of so goes Apple, so goes the rest of the market. And NVIDIA here a couple of years ago kind of took over the reins from Apple, in which kind of as NVIDIA goes, so goes the market. Now, the positive thing that I will say in regards to that is today, right now, we've got a pretty strong rally in the market, and NVIDIA is actually down. So maybe we're starting to break that tie that the market doesn't have to lean on one stock from one particular sector to feel good about things moving forward and going up off of that. NVIDIA had a very good quarter, beat on both the top and bottom line. The reality is for NVIDIA and them being down some today is NVIDIA's price for perfection.
Right.
A slight beat isn't what people are expecting because NVIDIA has been consistently crushing the estimates on a quarter-over-quarter basis. But they came in with a slight beat and even a slight guidance up on the next quarter's revenue off of that. And it appears as though there's some profit-taking and moving some of those dollars elsewhere as we have a pretty strong rally going on right now in the market, and it's pretty broad through across multiple sectors.
You know, I was talking to Glass on Wednesday, and I said, hey, the markets or a stock, a company, a price moves in expectation of what it hopes. You know, you'll have companies trading at 100 times earnings. Folks, that means you're paying 100 times current earnings for that stock. That's a lot. But you can look at other companies and say, wow, I'm only paying 13 times, 12 times, 15 times. And Rod, people over and over and over say, oh, the market's overvalued. The answer to that is no. The market might be overvalued from the S&P 500 standpoint, but individual stocks are actually fairly valued. So you shouldn't be freaking out if you're broadly diversified and not highly concentrated. That's why I've been in this bandwagon. I think the S&P 500, although it's been doing fantastic, led by the Mag 7, or some would even say maybe the Mag 12 in some instances, it could be the most risky sector because it is so highly concentrated. So the question is the market overvalued? I think the answer is in some areas, maybe, but in most areas, not.
Yeah, I think on average, you could easily say that because as you look at the forward-looking price-to-earnings ratio of the S&P 500, it sits at 23.43, and the five-year average is 21.33. The 15-year average is 17.89. So, yes, on average, it looks overvalued. But to the point you just made, if you actually stripped out the top 10 stocks in the S&P 500 and stripped their price-to-earnings multiple out of that equation and only focused on the other, I think the S&P is actually like 502 or 503 stocks, not even 500. But whatever, if you looked at the next 490 stocks, that the price-to-earnings multiple probably looks far more reasonable compared to the past than what you have including them. Now, as you and I have discussed, well, yes, you need to know how much exposure you have to those Mag 7s because they are such a big part of the S&P 500. Part of the reason that they have grown so much and they take up such a large share of that is because they have had real earnings and revenue growth along the way. So I think the biggest thing that we're trying to point out to people is not so much that, hey, Mag 7 is bad and avoid it, but don't be fooled into thinking that you're properly diversified because you own four or five of those Mag 7 stocks and then the rest of your money is sitting in the S&P 500. You probably have far more exposure to those seven stocks than what you ever really thought or realized that you had unless you sat down and do the math. So that's the biggest thing we keep trying to point out to people. Not that Mag 7 is bad or that it shouldn't be part of your portfolio. Just know and understand it is a heavy weighting in all of the major popular indexes. And if you think your diversification is by owning that index and then selectively picking some of those stocks, which may be part of the Mag 7, then you probably aren't as diversified as you thought you were.
I think Ford is still in the S&P 500, at least last time I looked, and I think it represented like 0.2 or 0.3% of the index. If you go Google and go to like images and put in S&P 500, pull it up and look at it, folks. I mean, if that image doesn't like tell its tale, then you're looking at the wrong image. It's pretty interesting, and I've used that a lot in presentations to say, hey, here's the S&P 500, which I think actually has like 504 stocks in it now, right, Rod, or something like that?
Yeah, it is a little over 500. I don't know the exact number of where you're at, but it is somewhere around 503 or 504.
Yeah, so here,
like the Big Ten. You know, the Big Ten used to be made up of 10 teams. It's now made up of 18. The S&P 500 used to be made up of 500 stocks. Now it's like 503 or 504.
I haven't seen I'm assuming there's a new image now for the Big Ten. I remember when we advanced to like, whatever, 11 teams. They had still the Big Ten, but in the middle it looked like, 11. I haven't really paid attention to what the new logo looks like for the Big 10/18. I'm sure they'll come up with something clever.
Yeah, I haven't noticed a change in it, but I also have not been looking at it for that change, to your point. When they did the first expansion, yeah, they kind of put that 11 in there to where it kind of showed within the Big Ten.
I've been
a standalone thing.
Indiana's going to get to play in the Rose Bowl on September like 8th or something, I think, because I've been inviting people. So I have access to the Colts games, and I try to invite people up. I usually have 9 or 10 total, and I've been asking this certain group of people that work together, hey, do you guys want to come? And it's like, no, man, we're out of town. And then I found out they're all going to the Rose Bowl, and I found another client of ours going to the Rose Bowl to watch Indiana play USC. So they're like, we haven't seen this happen since the 60s, so we're going, or whatever it was, 60, not, what, your Rose Bowl year, I think 67? Yeah, 67, maybe?
Yeah, I think 67.
Yeah, so people are excited about going back to the Rose Bowl, even though it's just a scheduling thing, but yeah, here we go, Indiana and UCLA, no, USC in the Rose Bowl. Right around the early part of September. We got Hoosiers kicking off on Saturday, Hot Rod. I know this is a financial show, not a sports show, and I know Glass gets kind of dinged around about, hey, I'd like to hear more of this, but all they talk about is sports. Pretty excited about the season coming up here on Labor Day weekend, kicking off against Florida International, 3:30 kickoff, tailgate in our normal spot. I'm pretty fired up and excited to see what Coach Sig's guys bring.
Yeah, me too. I've been saying for a long time. I went ahead and listened to Coach Dick when he was first hired, and
Google
he said,
me.
Google me,
yeah.
And I did, and I saw that he is a winner. So I am hoping he brings that here. There's no doubt he has generated a lot of enthusiasm and a lot of interest around the program, even from a recruiting perspective. You have recruits that we have never been able to attract that are at least kicking our tires. You know, none of them have committed, but if they don't first kick your tires, they're probably never going to commit. So it has to begin somewhere. The end result, as I keep saying to Glass, is there has to be wins on the field, and the product has to look good on the field.
No pass outs this year, guys. No pass outs.
Excitement. Right, goes away quickly. We're not looking for moral victories. We're also not looking for a perfect season.
Yeah.
You know, if Coach Dick can get off to a first season of six or more wins and go to a bowl game, I think that's a great start for his tenure here. And obviously we don't want that to be the peak of what Coach Dick brings to IU, but it most certainly be an excellent place to start.
Google Hot Rod Holloway, see what you find. Rod will let you go. He's a winner too, folks. He's a winner too. Rod, I'll see you back at the ranch. Thanks for your time, buddy.
Sounds good, Dave. Have a great show.
All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, is the U.S. Treasury the safe bet it once was? Research says. I have found an article that I thought was kind of interesting, and it goes along with some of the things that I've been talking about, how when they do these auctions, if you're interested, try to look up Treasury auctions and see how much of it the banks have to pull back. Was it 20%, 25%? That just basically means no one wants it. So if it's 20 years, 30-year bonds, they've been having a little bit more difficulty unloading those or getting rid of those. Everyone loves the short stuff, right? Who wouldn't want to buy 5% at, you know, 1 year, 1.5 years? So anyway, when we come back, I'm not trying to read into this too deep. I'm just trying to keep people aware of things. We'll be right back at Your Money with David Hayes. Well, I was going to do why is gold outperforming nearly everything so far this year as well. Article I read from Yahoo Finance talked about the Bank of America Global Research Gold Fund just absorbed the largest inflows in 4 weeks, attracting $1.1 billion. Yet the trend has actually seen some outflows this year as well. They said it's besides U.S. dollars, the overall global stock up of gold is something that we've never seen before. Why is that, folks? Why is that? Well, a lot of different theories there. I mean, one is inflation, right? We've had global inflation, not just nationally here. Some places it's out of control. I'm actually going to Tanzania. You know, I was in Argentina last year and Brazil in 2019, I'm sorry. And, you know, when you look at what $1 is in their currencies, I mean, it's like, wow. And it's kind of throws you off too. When you look at something that says it's 30,000, whatever it is currency that they have. And you're like, okay, how much is that in US? And you're like, oh, it's $6, you know? So that's the reality of it. So yeah, globally people are like, well, I think I'd like to have some of this gold on hand because it has traditionally gone up in value with inflation. It is treated as a, not as a commodity, but as a, you know, something that's a collectible. And it's interesting because collectibles are taxed differently than commodities or anything else that you buy and sell. It's a higher tax rate. But I was watching a video from First Eagle, who has a lot of gold, and we've had Julian here on the show. I'm going to go out to Boston, New York with Doug sometime. We're going to have dinner with him and see their headquarters and maybe grab a game or something while I'm out there. But, yeah, they sent a video of how they, you know, Bank of America, right, they have all this gold stored, and this country or this company or this mutual fund wants to sell it. They get them on the big carts, and they wheel them over to the other area and put them back in there. And it's insanely simple, really, how they just move it from one vault over to the or one cage to the other cage. So, but anyway. But let's move on. So long touted as hands down the world's safe haven in securities, the behavior of U.S. treasuries during and after the COVID-19 calls that into question, suggesting there are little differences between the debt issued by Germany, the Bund, right? Britain, the gilt. I love that, right? The gilt. France, right? Like the oat, or even big corporations. The key finding of this research presented by the Kansas City Fed's annual research conference in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, it examines a shift in investor behavior in a period that raises the question about the exorbitant privilege the U.S. government has long enjoyed to borrow broadly on a global market even as federal budget gaps grow wider. It's a timely question, given growing deficits are seen as a near certainty regardless of who becomes the next U.S. president. New York University, London business guru, blah, 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 also throws that into question. The assertion that the Treasury market was dysfunctional in that period, as asserted by the Federal Reserve when it launched its massive bond buying, or just rationally pricing the risk of a massive unfunded spending shock that is being prepared in response to the healthy emergency, right? So, okay, so they're just saying, is it irresponsible or is it just a response to an emergency? Is this long living? And they're saying this thing's going to stick around for a while. In response to COVID, U.S. Treasury investors seem to have shifted to risky debt models when pricing treasuries. It goes on to say, researchers looked at the behavior of Treasury securities during the pandemic shutdown of 2020 when yields shot higher, not just for U.S. debt, but for bonds issued by nations across the globe. They found that investors did not, as they had during previous episodes of global financial stress, pile into treasuries like in 2008. In 2008 and going into 2009, what went down? Everything. Stocks, bonds, real estate, gold, everything went down except for U.S. treasuries. They went up. But people typically pile into treasuries and drive up their value instead of investors mark down treasury securities much as they did for bonds from other countries. So they're saying, okay, you're issuing how much in debt? $3.2 trillion? What? They don't even know what a trillion is. I remember Hot Rod saying, you know what? The first $1 trillion spending bill that goes through, people are going to choke on it. They're going to like, I can't believe this. Herald. But once it goes through the first time, the second time, it's always easier. And that's what's happened. They're like, wait a second. Well, in 2008, we piled into treasuries because we were really nervous about the global financial recession, almost depression. But this time, when we had a situation where we need a flight to safety, it's like, I'm not sure about this. The treasuries, I'm not sure about this. So they find, let's see here. Meanwhile, the U.S. Federal Reserve responded to the spike in U.S. yields as if it were a result of a market dislocation, they said, buying up bonds to bring back order to the world's usually most liquid debt market as they had in the global financial crisis. The risky debt regime valuations will respond to government spending shocks, which may involve large yield changes in bond markets, the research says, noting they found especially big market moves on the days when fiscal stimulus was announced. Okay, so we question this over and over and over. I need to do a new commercial. I keep getting reminded of that because I keep saying, okay, you know, alert, we're now $34 trillion in debt. No, we're not. We're more than that, and we have $1 trillion deficits, and we've got to come up with money somehow, and you're seeing potential policies out of the Democratic side with Kamala saying, okay, we're going to maybe tax unrealized gain. Remember, guys, I've told you this for years. I don't know what's going to happen with carry forward basis. I don't know what's going to happen with capital gains. I don't know what's going to happen with the federal estate tax. I don't know what's going to happen with income taxes. But what I do know is that this year, and I'm going to do a segment when we come back on this, but this year and all of next year, we know what we're up against. And we know that I can control one thing, and that is the taxes on my retirement account. And I either can choose or not choose, which, by the way, not doing anything is a choice, to do something about it and pay the tax now. Maybe it's 10, maybe it's 12, maybe it's 20, maybe it's 37%. I don't care what it is, but let's downsize this taxable burden that you're going to have in the future and do something about it now. And the numbers are not just, you know, what did it say? It says something about factual or tax. I'm trying to look at the article again. Anyway, it's basically saying the exorbitant privilege of the U.S. It's just saying that it's not even a guess anymore. It's just facts. So let's take a break. When we come back, do you know where your kids are? It's 10 p.m. Have you seen that commercial? It's back. I remember seeing that years and years ago. But it's almost September. Do you know what tax bracket you're in? We'll be right back. It's Your Money with David Ace. Oh, I almost forgot. All of you were on pins and needles when I announced that I was going to say, where do you stand, right, in the rankings when it comes to your tax returns in 2024? Income tax returns were due back in April. The extension goes through the month of October, which is when mine will get filed. It always is the very last minute. It's crazy when I see my CPA's timestamp and it says 11:58 p.m. on October 17th or whatever the final day will be. And it's like, all right, well, you got it done. I guess I'm not going to worry about it. But it is, I love the commercial, right? It's 10 p.m. Do you know where your kids are? Now, I don't know what station that's on. Maybe it's on a lot of stations. That commercial's back. It used to always be there where you would say as a parent, oh, you know what? I don't know where my kid is. Wonder where he is and check on him. But it's almost September, right? Do you know what tax bracket you're in? Time is ticking. Time is running out. Time to act is now. By now, you probably have a pretty good idea of how much income you'll have this year. And you can do some planning. And good news is we still have, you know, the September, October, November, December months to do this, which is to move money from taxable to tax-free, pay it now, never to pay again. Compound growth of tax-free money is enticing. The transfer of wealth is enticing. There's just so many great reasons to do it. There are some gotchas coming along here, right? If you own mutual funds that are not inside of an IRA, Roth, or traditional, there will be some mutual fund distributions. I'm starting to see some estimates come out already. So if you own mutual funds, you might look to see what those estimates will be. And this is the situation that happens every year. A mutual fund, so it has to pass through 90% of its realized gains and dividends to the shareholders. And that's you and me. So every year we get these. Sometimes it's 10% of the fund is distributed. Sometimes it's nothing. You never know what it's going to be. So find that out, because that is important to know before you do the Roth conversions and you know what tax bracket you're in and all that. But, you know, sometimes it's not that big of a deal. If you go from 22 to 24, who really cares? And there's so much capacity in the 24% bracket. And remember, we live in a next dollar system. We live in a marginal system. So you have your free money, which is your standard deduction for, what, 86% of Americans. Then you have a 10% leg. If you're married, filing joint, it's almost 20 grand. Then you have a 12% leg, which is another 50 plus thousand. Then and only then do you pay the next dollar at 22, and that's a really big leg. And then and only then do you pay it at 24 before you start jumping up into the higher brackets. But, you know, it's just a next dollar system, so it doesn't really matter, honestly, that much if you just barely tick over into another bracket. It just means that dollar gets taxed at that bracket. So, but it is September. Do you know what tax bracket you are in? Now, speaking of taxes, how many millionaires, I'm not going to talk about that. Tax returns by income group for 2024. Okay, so far in 2024, as of the end of May, there was 132 million tax returns filed. I guess that's possible. Yeah, that's probably about right. We had 1 million people that had no income. That's 1% of people. So if you want to be in the 1%, everyone's like, I want to be in the 1%. Well, you could also have no income and still be in the 1%. But let's see here. This is adjusted gross income. So let's get up here to like 100 to 200,000. That is actually the highest category. 17.25% of people, 22 million tax returns were filed with $100,000 to $200,000 of income. $250,000 to $500,000, only 3.46% of the tax returns had that kind of income. And here's the one percenters, folks, on the other side. $500,000 to $1 million is 0.77% of all tax returns, over $1 million. If you have a tax return that you report, and I know I've seen several of these, which is interesting, that only this is really interesting. This tells you, I don't even know what this tells you, but of the total returns of 132 million plus, it says as of May, now maybe people are on extension that have a lot, that make a lot of money, only 285,000 returns made over $1 million. That's 0.22%. I'm looking forward to the end of October and pulling this up again to see what happens. But that's where people fall. I mean, a lot of people fall between 50, majority of people, 30, 40, almost 50% of people fall between 50 and $200,000 a year. So don't know. So you want to know where you stand? You might be feeling pretty good about yourself by now. All right, let's take a quick break. Come back. What else we got to talk about? Oh, a time-honored strategy that puts your retirement risk. I love these titles. Of financial ruin. I'm not going to get that serious. No, here's what I want to talk about. You don't want that tax-invested inherited IRA. You can disclaim it away. What are the best assets to leave to people and which ones you should leave to charity? We'll be right back at Your Money with David Hayes. All right, I'm not going to talk about the time-honored strategy that puts your retirement funds at financial ruins, but it's talking about the 60-40, the tried-and-true portfolio and 4% withdrawal rate and all that kind of stuff. And so I'm not going to get into that, but it's something I could save for another day. Let's talk about this. So you inherit a retirement account. Now, if you're the spouse, you just get to make it your own, so that's not a big deal. But what if you are a child or a grandchild or whatever, and you inherit an IRA. Well, now, and it's not a Roth, by the way, now you have to deal with it. You have to deal with the tax consequences of inheriting a tax-infested retirement account, which is an inherited IRA. But what if there's other assets that they have? Well, other assets may come to you tax-favored. Life insurance proceeds, send that to a person, not a charity. Roth, send it to a person, not a charity. Stock, real estate, farmland, whatever, send that to a person, not a charity. So don't put it in your will to leave a bunch of money to a charity. Put it on your beneficiary form on your tax-infested IRAs. So what can a beneficiary do? Well, they can disclaim it away, right? You can. So if you have done a good job as a family and you've gotten your IRA down to the point where it's not horrible, but maybe it is horrible. Maybe it's really big, right, and tax-infested. Well, I could set up a donor-advised fund. Let's just use me as an example. I could set up a donor-advised fund right now. I could put highly appreciated stock into it, get my tax deduction, choose who and how I give it to later, and then I can name it on the – my dad could name it on the beneficiary form as a successor beneficiary, or through some kind of a trust would probably work better. And then I could say when he passed away, hey, you know what? I'm going to disclaim, let's just make it up and say it's $100,000. I'm going to disclaim $75,000 of that to my charitable donor advised fund. And it basically bypasses me, goes right into the donor advised fund, tax-free because the donor advised fund's a charity, even though I get to direct where that money goes. And I'll take 25 of it and pay the tax. Then, over my entire life, I can slowly divvy out the old man's IRA money to all the wonderful charities that he supported, the churches and the charities that he desired to give to. And then maybe my dad said, okay, but I'm going to leave 10% to the church, but I want it to be from the IRA. So he could have all the kids listed as beneficiaries, contingent beneficiaries. We would have our own opportunity to disclaim to a successor trustee or a successor beneficiary, like a donor advised fund. And then maybe dad said, hey, I want to leave some money to the church myself directly. He can put them on there too. So like I tell people all the time, do not put the charities in your will. Don't put them in your trust. Put them on a beneficiary form and just monitor it every year. And if you have a specific amount, peel it off and make it its own individual IRA. Make the charity the sole and only beneficiary to that fund, and that's it. So if you desire to leave $10,000 to your favorite church or charity, or a multiple group of charities, decide how much that is. Don't put it in the will to leave $50,000 divided up between the Humane Society and this church and this different charity. Slide it over into its own IRA. You can take minimum distributions from other IRAs to cover that. Put all the charities on it, and there you go. But also keep in mind that if a child says, you know what, I want to disclaim some of the inherited IRA that I'm going to get and not pay tax on it to something, create a donor advised fund, get with an attorney who knows how to do this kind of stuff, and if you need help, email me, cfci.us. I'll walk you through it and hopefully be able to help you out. All right? It's a pretty cool thing, and this came from a real-life situation. Just recently it came up. And me and the attorney were, mentally going back and forth on the best way to handle it. I'm like, this is the way we should do it. And he's like, I agree. It's always good when your advisors agree. All right, let's take a break. Come back. We'll wrap this thing up. It's Your Money with David Hayes. You know, for all you dog lovers out there like me and my wife, we've always had dogs. Our very first dog was a Shih Tzu, and I was always a big dog guy. But Princess, she died, and it was very sad. But here came Hunter Bear, as we call him, 18 years ago. So Willie was just a little guy. I have a great picture of him laying on the couch with him. And he's 18, and he's on his last leg, and it's sad. Sad day for me. We'll see how it all shakes out. But anyway, we have a great picture of him with Will just like a week ago. So if you see any Facebook posts for my wife or maybe for me, just keep the family in your heart, because everyone who's had to put a dog down knows exactly how it feels. It feels like crap, especially when your wife's out of town. It's not a good day for me. But anyway, so I've been came in a little early to record today, canceled a few appointments this afternoon, and I'm going to head home and see what we need to do to make his life better and, frankly, our life easier, because it's a challenge, you know, when you have a dog that's been part of your family for so long, and people listening that are dog people are like, yep, I get it, Dave. I get exactly what you're talking about. People that are not dog lovers, they're probably like, I don't get it. I don't understand what you're talking about. Why would you be so hung up and so emotional about a dog? Well, it's more than that, and I think people that have dogs know that, and especially when your kids grow up. They always say you get your first dog when you're a kid, and they always die when you go to college. And my son is 23, and he's out of school, and like everyone knows who listens, he's selling cars out on the Royal on the East Side, doing a great job. But I texted him last night and said, hey, if you want to say you want to see Hunter, you probably should come over. And he said he'll be there after work. So I'm hoping when I go home that he's peacefully passed away. But if he hasn't, we're going to have to do the hard thing, I think, and have old Art come over. And he's a good guy. Art, retired vet, but he still told us that if we need him, he would come to put our dogs to rest. So that's what's going to happen. And everyone's been through it, knows how it feels. It feels terrible. So I'm going to try to focus on the positive of the wonderful weekend ahead of us, the football games, Little League football, lake time, and all the great things that life brings. So life is short for all of us. But 18 years old for a dog, a Springer Spaniel, dude, that's like 120, 130 years old. So he's had a great life. And I always say, folks, if you believe in reincarnation, which I don't really do, I don't really believe in that, but some do, that you want to be reincarnated with one of my wife's dogs, because they are very well taken care of, very well treated, very well fed. And they live a long time. That's just the way it is. So have a great weekend, everyone. I hope you have a great one. I'll talk to you next week. Happy Labor Day. Bye-bye.
The preceding program was brought to you by Comprehensive Financial Consultants and CFCI, which is solely responsible for its content. Securities are offered through J.W. Cole Financial, member FINRA and SIPC. Investment advice offered through CFCI and J.W. Cole Advisors. J.W. Cole Financial, J.W. Cole Advisors, and CFCI are unaffiliated entities.